Arizona State University has been forming partnerships at a rapid rate lately as it pushes to increase innovation and sustainability in higher education. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with ASU President Michael Crow about the newest international alliance with colleges in England and Australia. We'll also discuss how his bigger vision for a new American university fits with the mission of a state university. And does he believe ASU is getting shortchanged by the legislature? Plus, the United States has been fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11 with a level of firepower never seen before. But what happens as the nature of war continues to change when there's more focus on terrorism and cybercrime? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and national security expert Thomas Ricks talks with me about why he's concerned the U.S. could lose its next war. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, the United States has been fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11 with a level of firepower never seen before. But what happens as the nature of war continues to change when there's more focus on terrorism and cybercrime? I'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and national security expert Thomas Ricks about why he's concerned the U.S. could lose its next war. Also, former MacArthur fellow Robert Moses is in the Valley to promote the importance of math literacy in low-income and minority communities. I'll ask Moses why math can have such a positive impact. We start today's program with Arizona State University President Michael Crow. The university has announced a new partnership called the PLUS Alliance with two other institutions of higher learning, King's College of London and the University of New South Wales in Australia. The partnership focuses on innovation and sustainability. Dr. Crow, what are some of the issues this particular alliance will be focused on? What are some of the goals?
Well, one of the things that we know on the education side is that the world's going to see several billion people added to the middle class in the foreseeable future, let's say the next decade and a half. The middle class around the planet, including in the United States, is looking for educational attainment as one of the principal things they'd like to achieve. And so we're looking to work with local universities in these various developing countries as their partner. Between these three great universities in Australia, Britain, and the United States. So that's one specific thing that we think that we can do in terms of operating at scale. And then on specific kinds of challenges or projects or problems, you know, we're already being approached by governments around the world and by companies around the world to help solve really large issues as they relate to sustainability. Can you help on water issues in Mexico and the United States? Can we work together on issues associated with climate change in Vietnam and at scale? And so what turns out to be the case is that while each individual university, think of them like small cottage shops in the old Middle Ages, they've got quite a few experts, but they don't have enough of the expertise. They've got a little of this and a little of that, but they don't have this or that. And so how can we really rapidly evolve teams to take on a problem like sea level rise in Vietnam? That's something that we're looking at. Those are the kinds of challenges that we think that we can engage on in really rapid fire by being organized essentially as a global institution as opposed to just a regional institution.
And ultimately, can there be, when it comes to facing problems like this, even if one nation perhaps is facing it in a different time frame than another, is there a way to build almost a map for this to say that if this worked in this nation the way we did it as a team, it can then work if this nation has a similar problem?
Absolutely. So there's learning by doing and then expressing that learning by doing through training programs, through joint centers and initiatives. So absolutely. So if we can figure out how to deal with water allocation and water decision making in the Middle East, or food security in some part of the world, or in sustainable management of wildlife systems somewhere, working with local experts, local universities, and then this global institution that we're building. If we can solve it here, then that becomes a roadmap to solve it somewhere else. So a problem solved in South America can then become a solution option for a problem in Africa.
Now, you've been forming partnerships and collaborations with many interesting groups, other businesses, this sort of thing. Why were these two universities a good fit for what you're trying to do?
Well, I went down to Sydney to the University of New South Wales, and I found a kindred spirit to ASU, fast-moving, new, highly evolved, really focused on use-inspired scholarship, scaled, operating on a global basis. And then both of us together then say to ourselves, well, we're kind of newbies, if you will, and we need the stalwart. We need one of the originals. And so in London, we found King's College London under the leadership of Principal Ed Byrne, that's what they call their president. They call him Principal. Ed is a fantastically innovative leader of one of the world's classic universities. So we're bringing together two young entrepreneurial universities that are moving forward very rapidly with a classic London-based, London-centered, globally positioned university into a single alliance. This alliance then becomes, as you suggested, another tool for ASU. So we have the University Innovation Alliance of 11 American research universities that are innovating together that I'm the chairman of. Now we have this global alliance, which will work on educational attainment in the developing world and will work on the questions of sustainability in the developing world. And so this alliance then adds to and augments and enhances our ability to get things done for people here in Arizona also, because these two schools will now start influencing us in positive ways and in creative ways.
Is there anything at this point that can bring countries, can bring universities together better than science and technology and innovation? Because it seems like there is no language barrier when it comes to those things.
Well, there's no language barrier within the science and technology realm. And among universities that are guided by the original principles for which universities evolved, which is this whole notion of seeking the creation of knowledge, the discovery of new things, the transfer of knowledge. If you hold those as core principles, we have a commonality of culture and a commonality of purpose. Now you take then the individual characteristics of these universities and you marry them together, and now we've grown exponentially our ability to respond to challenges and opportunities from what any of us can individually do. We don't have program X at ASU, but they have it at University of New South Wales. We then link those two together. And then all of a sudden we've got a whole new way of doing things or a whole new way of thinking about things. And then imagine this across a broader spectrum of institutions. And then also, we've been working in this realm for a while. You know, we launched a few months ago the Global Freshman Academy with our partner edX, which is a multi-university partner headed by MIT and Harvard. We've had 55,000 plus students in the first three classes of that from 163 countries. And so ASU has evolved, in a sense, in a highly accelerated way from a regional university to a national, from a territorial teachers college to a regional college to a regional university to a national research university now to a global institution overnight. So we're now operating as a global institution. And in that regard, back to our charter in terms of our commitment to the health and well-being of Arizona, we think we can be of greater service to Arizona by being a part of these alliances and drawing in the lessons learned and the talent and the expertise. So the faculty of the University of New South Wales now, which is in Sydney, which is a fantastically successful city, and the faculty of King's College London in downtown central London, right on the Thames River, those two faculties now become assets to Arizona State University right here in Arizona. So we'll be looking at how to draw from their expertise and how to do new kinds of things through our relationships, rather than us having to go out and build, let's say, expertise in 40 languages and cultures that we don't teach. King's College London has those 40 languages and cultures that we don't teach. Rather than needing to construct a globally capable public health program like King's College already has, we just draw on theirs and we work with them. And so likewise with University of New South Wales, they have, as we do, unbelievable research in advanced technology as it relates to sustainability, as it relates to water and energy. Two of the most important things that the future has in store for us is to solve those two problems. We think we can do a better job of solving those problems for Arizona by working with the University of New South Wales in this space.
When you wanted to build what you've called the New American University, can you take us back a decade? Did you think it was really possible at ASU?
Well, you're talking to a person that believes that anything that you think about hard enough and long enough and you work on hard enough is going to be possible. So did I think it was possible? Yes. I think, though, that we have exceeded what I thought was doable in the time frame that we have been able to work at this. And so this has been 13 years. Unbelievable place. The fertile soil of the Arizona environment for innovation and creativity is really fantastic. It's really unbelievable. So we've been able to make that happen. And so we've exceeded where I thought that we could get to. That is, we've shot past the notion of just being yet another national American research university. And now we're now emerging as this global institution research activities around the world, working on global problems that are of material interest here in Arizona, but also developing a global position as one of, if not the leading center for innovation in higher education. And so all these things have been possible because we are unencumbered here in Arizona in terms of our ability to move quickly and to innovate. So I've been very pleased with the progress that we've made.
How does that jibe with what the high school student from Arizona who has done well in high school and wants to go to Arizona State but considers it, wants to have this vision but maybe isn't quite ready for that? Where's the compatibility there, Dr. Crow, when it comes to serving the state students, good students, but maybe students who are not yet thinking globally?
Well, you know, I think that it's completely compatible. We've found fantastic success with our Arizona students. We found that our students have really adjusted to the new ASU. We've doubled the four-year graduation rate. We have greatly increased the diversity of our students. I think they found excitement in the programs that we're offering, the transdisciplinary schools that we have. In this new program, they'll be able to take courses at these other campuses, from these other campuses here in Arizona, expanding their learning horizon. They'll be able to go to these other campuses, just as a part of their normal educational experience. And so I think that this, you know, it's not going to be the community that stays local that's going to be successful in the ever-increasing globalized economy. It's going to be the place that is able to operate on a global scale. And so what we're doing is we're making the local university capable of doing that with this alliance and with other things that we're doing. And I think that there's only benefit for the students from Arizona. And let me reiterate that we remain deeply committed to one of our core values, which is the notion of inclusivity and the success of our students, as opposed to being exclusive. And so the broadest range of thinkers, all the hearts of the young people in Arizona that dream about the future, we've got a place for them to move forward, and we're just adding this as a dimensionality to what we're doing.
When we have a place, especially at the legislative level, where some people are not as enthusiastic about doing the sort of traditional funding that state universities had gotten used to, was this something that you would have done regardless, wanting to have innovative partnerships? But at the same time, is there something to be said for showing some of the people, some of the elected leaders in the state that look at all these things we're doing? That's another reason why you should increase what you give us funding-wise.
Well, I think both things are a fair assessment. So we did lay out 8 design aspirations upon my appointment, and we set these up as aspirations that we could work toward. The 8th is global engagement. We had one that was related to the university acting in an entrepreneurial way. All of these are manifestations of that. We've proven that this model, when you invest in it, only produces fantastic products for the future of Arizona, both in the form of people and in the form of ideas. And so I think it is fair to say to the legislature or to other potential investors in the university that every dollar that you invest in this institution will net a return to the state, both to the individuals that participate in the institution, to the people that they impact, the people that we impact. But overall, the net return to the state is dramatic and positive, particularly given the shift in the global economy to a knowledge-driven, high-speed, high-change, high-technology economy. Those are all things that we bring to the table.
During the State of the State address, Governor Ducey gave you specifically, not just the university, but you specifically, great praise for some of the things you've done at ASU. And then later in the week, we found out that his budget request was not exactly huge when it came to the universities. Do those things fit together, the idea that a governor would say great things about what you're accomplishing and then not really back it up with funding?
You know, I think the good thing that the governor did in this year's budget proposal was to accept a model built on providing support to Arizona's residents at the public universities. And so I think that's fantastic. The governor didn't start out there. He got there. He's embraced the model. That's the right model to have. The fluidity of the financial situation of the state is such that What he proposed was a startup package for that model. What we're hoping now with the additional information that we have now moving forward, the kind of resources that the state has available, is that the legislature now will invest not $8 million in this first year of the new model, but $32 million in this first year of the model. And so we're making that case vigorously to the legislature now. And then our hope is over time that they will fund about half the cost of attendance, half the cost of instruction for in-state students. We think that's fair and reasonable and a lower cost on a dollar basis than the state has invested on average for the previous several decades. So we've improved our efficiency. We've built the university that I think that the politicians can be satisfied is efficient and effective. I think we're a better institution than we were, and we're asking them now to invest in the better institution. And the governor's strategy has set up a mechanism for them to be able to do that, and now we hope that the legislature will step up.
That's Arizona State University President Dr. Michael Crove, and talking about the PLUS Alliance. ASU is teaming up with King's College of London and the University of New South Wales to help develop sustainable solutions to the challenges of the world. Dr. Crove, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll look at the controversy at the Phoenix City Council over opening prayers, and then later this hour, the future of war. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Holland America Line, offering more than 500 cruise itineraries to destinations across the globe, including Europe, the Caribbean, and Alaska. Information available through a travel professional or at hollandamerica.com.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Be with us today at 1 for BBC NewsHour. Well, sunshine across Arizona at this hour. It's 44 degrees in Tucson, 43 in Casa Grande, 54 in Yuma, 27 in Prescott, and a balmy 21 degrees right now in Flagstaff. Become a KJZZ business member and get connected with an audience that values public radio for balanced, factual information. Help keep this community resource strong with a philanthropic donation to the KJZZ Business Member Program. Learn more at businessmember.kjzz.org or call 480-774-8274. Sunshine right now over Phoenix, 34% relative humidity, and it's 48 degrees at 1123.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Later today, the Phoenix City Council will consider whether to change its policy of having members of different groups offer the invocation at the beginning of council meetings. A controversy was created recently when the Satanic Temple of Tucson submitted a request with Phoenix's city clerk's office. But several members of the council want to implement a new rule that would lead to stopping the satanic group from delivering the prayer. With me to talk about the issue is Tracy Fessenden, professor of religious studies at ASU. Professor, good morning.
Good morning.
How much of this for you comes down to religious freedom? Before we get into some of the aspects of secularism, is this at the core of this, religious freedom?
Well, it seems to me, Steve, that the Satanic Temple is very much eager to prompt a discussion about religious freedom. My understanding of their positions strikes me as not entirely unusual. They look to me like garden variety secular humanists, but in calling themselves Satanists, they seem to be very focused on creating a confrontation, creating a discussion about the limits and the scope of religious freedom.
Is this a discussion that needs to be had, whether prayers or invocations of any sort should accompany meetings and council meetings like this?
Well, I think it's potentially a very fruitful discussion, and it's a puzzle or a question that is really built into the way that we think about religion in this country, and the again, the scope of religious freedom. If the prayers are by design open to all, then there is no conflict between the governing function of the city council and the religious or spiritual element that is brought into their business by the religious groups. But if the opening prayer is restricted to certain groups, then we do potentially have a conflict. We do potentially have the state acting as the arbiter of what counts as legitimate religion and illegitimate religion. And that seems to be what this group is trying to put some pressure on, again, to elicit a different kind of conversation.
Is this the sort of issue that we are seeing more of, that we will be seeing more of? It does seem as though those who are traditionally religious, it seems like those that are still the regular church attendees, the temple attendees, what have you, are the folks who are much more passionate about this. And it feels like there are some who are just sort of, okay, this is fine, whether it's secular humanism, whatnot. It's a little prayer at the beginning of a council meeting. But are we seeing people becoming more entrenched in this issue and wanting to debate it more?
Well, I think it's always been a hot button issue. I think in the last couple of years we have seen certain events, the Supreme Court decision in Hobby Lobby, for example, or some of the new focus on the Muslim presence in Europe and in America. This has, I think, for some people, raised the temperature around some of these issues. But, you know, the question of the scope of religious freedom is really quite an old question in America. One of the earliest works of American religious history, a 19th century work called Religion in America, said that religious freedom, of course, it's our American inheritance, it's our great achievement, our great gift, but it really only extends to religion and not to what this writer called irreligion. And under irreligion, he put Catholicism, Judaism, Mormonism. They're not allowed religious freedom. It's only the recognizable forms of religion that are given public space and a public voice. So the question of what religions are allowed religious freedom is one that we can't really duck if we're going to be true to this vision of religious freedom as legitimately non-sectarian.
And some have expressed concern as well that if you're not a member of a certain group, when it comes to, let's say, a public meeting like this, mm-hmm. that you will feel left out. So in essence, it's putting a wedge in between groups of people that maybe a public council meeting shouldn't be doing.
Yes, yes. And I think that certainly is another point that the Satanic Temple wishes to make, that if only religious groups are allowed a seat at the table, then many people are being excluded from participation on the basis of their decision, which of course is a constitutionally protected decision to not practice a religion.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Tracy Fessenden, professor of religious studies at ASU, about today's Phoenix City Council meeting, which will decide whether or not to continue to have opening prayers or whether the policy will change. Professor, what about this? Some have talked about the myth of secularism.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? Is there a feeling that as a society, more people want to move towards secularism? Is there lip service being paid to that? Is it a good idea?
Well, I think, you know, secularism is one of those words we all think we understand, but we can use it in conversation with very different meanings attached to it. Secularism for some means that our public spaces will be religious-free zones. Others would highlight the protection given to all religions in a secular polity, which separates church and state, so doesn't give the sort of national or the civic stamp of approval to any religions, but invites religious participation from all. Those are two very different understandings. If the public sphere is open to all religions, and that's secularism, that's one view. If the public sphere is closed to all religions, that's a very different view of secularism. I don't think that the latter, the idea of a public sphere that would be free of religion, is possible or desirable. I don't think that we could banish religion from the public sphere any more than we could banish learning or art or music from the public sphere. It would be a fool's errand to try to do that. I think we do need to be careful about giving a kind of implicit approval to certain kinds of religion and not others in our effort to be inclusive and democratic when it comes to religion. And I think that this is the issue that is being raised today in Phoenix.
About a minute or so left, and I hate to put you on the spot, but since we are talking about the council meeting and knowing how politicians are, neither one of us is a politician, but are there certain things that would make sense to you based on what you know about the controversy that might make an incremental step, might be a compromise?
Oh, you know, my sense is that there will be an effort to limit the religious groups to who are able to speak to make it an invitation-only setup, and I think that is going to raise all kinds of legal challenges, which will be very interesting to watch and will, I think, bring about this conversation that the Satanic Temple wants us to have.
Tracy Fessenden is a professor of religious studies at ASU. Professor, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
The United States has been fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11, with a level of firepower never seen before. But what happens as the nature of war continues to change, when there's more focus on terrorism and cybercrime? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and national security expert Thomas Ricks has strong opinions about those topics, and will be talking about them next Monday night at ASU as part of the Paul Schott Memorial Lecture, and he joins me now. Tom Ricks, how is the nature of war changing, and is it changing more rapidly now than it has in the past?
America tend to think of war as state on state. World War II is kind of our ideal. Nations, great powers, fighting each other on battlefields. The problem is when you're really good at that, your adversaries will find other ways to come at you. They might come at you through terrorism, they might come at you through the domain of cyber warfare, or they may simply find other ways to attack you, ways you might not even know. It could be diseases. In the age of drones, we're also seeing much more firepower and mobility in the hands of individuals. So that does away also with the definition of what an adversary is. It's not necessarily Nazi Germany anymore. It might be a disgruntled individual who has a beef with the U.S. government.
So does the U.S. then, when we talk about these outside forces and the changes, does the U.S. have a choice then in what wars it fights, or are outside forces sort of deciding that for us?
You always have a choice in whether you fight. Then you have a choice in how you fight. Do you define it as fighting a crime or as fighting a war? Because very different rules then apply. I think at home, it's almost always better to define something as a crime. I think we made a huge mistake, for example, when we started talking about a war on drugs. I think it would have been much better to decriminalize drugs and treat it as a problem, and something that the community needed to work with rather than some sort of big war. I think every time we call something a war, especially at home, we make a big mistake.
Do we need to change something structurally to deal with the future of war better? Do we need less bureaucracy, more creativity, less commitment to what you talked about before, that sort of World War II ideal?
I think we need to do all those things, but I think most of all we need to think. There's an old saying in the military, we run out of money and now we have to think. It's actually one reason I advocate a smaller defense budget. Money is an easy way to stop thinking. We all have come across rich people, especially kids who inherited money, and all it gave them was trouble because they didn't have to think. They didn't even have to learn how to get a job. Our U.S. military now, very heavily funded over the last 15 years, kind of has a sense of entitlement to give us all the money we asked for. And I worry sometimes that what we're doing is spending instead of thinking. And this is the subject of my talk that I'm giving at Arizona State, is that we are looking a lot like the British military after World War I. They said, we have the best army in the world. We have the biggest navy in the world. They were the only country with aircraft carriers, and I think by the end of World War I, they had about seven of them. Yet by the beginning of World War II, they were in very poor shape as a military, especially the Royal Navy, which really did not understand the world it was facing. The Royal Navy in 1939, the British Navy, was the biggest navy in the world, had more firepower, had a lot of great battleships, and was almost irrelevant in World War II, especially the battleships. What they needed, what they should have built, was destroyers, aircraft carriers, and submarines. But they didn't understand the world they were operating in. Why? Partly because they had too much money in the late 1910s and the early 1920s, and they didn't think. The Americans and the Japanese, by contrast, had very little money, but they thought. And they thought especially about aircraft carriers. How do you use them? What's the role of them? They came to understand that the aircraft carrier was not the eyes for the battleship. It actually was the new striking arm of the fleet. It was the thing around you which you built your navy. British didn't get it. So they wasted a lot of money on battleships, and they wounded in World War II, fat, dumb, slow, and stupid. And I worry that we will do the same thing, spend so much money instead of thinking about how to fight in the future.
Is part of that the political dynamic, the fact that a lot of members of Congress get criticized for wanting to bring home jobs to their area? Some of that means military equipment, certain kinds of firepower that a lot of people will argue we really don't need.
I think bringing home the pork is part of it, but a larger problem is we have a nation that really doesn't understand military operations much anymore. As late as the Vietnam War, two-thirds of the Congress had military experience. Now that number, I believe, is about 20% and going down fast. So we have a Congress that doesn't understand the military. We have people that don't understand the military. And we have a culture that kind of venerates the military without asking tough questions. If you really want to help your military, don't be a cheerleader. Push them. Ask them tough questions. And that's what I'm trying to do in the talk I'm giving at Arizona State and in the things I write on my blog and Foreign Policy Magazine as well. Push the military. Ask the tough questions. I think that is a patriotic act and can help our military adjust. We have a great industrial-age military. Our problem is we are now living in the beginning of the information age. And what is required to be effective might be very different. Quick example, in the industrial age, mass was almost always a good thing. The more people, the more machines, the more fuel, the better. In the information age, when precision weaponry is on the battlefield and when surveillance drones and satellites are overhead, mass may be a vulnerability. Similarly, in the industrial age, effectiveness was your major measure. Were you effective? But in a time of great change, effectiveness might not be the best metric. The best metric might be adaptiveness. How adaptive are you? How quickly can you change? And so the way you measure your military, the way you decide it's effective or useful, might be very different. But we're not asking those type of questions. Congress doesn't ask those type of questions because they don't know enough about today's military. And the people don't know enough to push their congressmen to ask.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and national security expert Tom Ricks. He'll be at ASU, as he mentioned, next Monday for the Paul Schott Memorial Lecture. It's going to be part of the First Amendment Forum at the Cronkite School of Journalism. Tom, when you talk about why you fear we'll lose our next big war, what is it like to win a war? I think there are a lot of people in the U.S. who would say Vietnam was not a win. What's going on in the Middle East since 9/11, these are not, there are wins in the course of it, overall not wins necessarily. So what would it feel like to win? What does a win look like now?
Wins can be very different depending on the nature of the war. In retrospect, the Korean War, which people denigrated then as a tie, I actually think was a win. We kept South Korea free, and South Korea is now a large and powerful economy and a very good ally of the United States. World War II is a classic win, and one of the things to study is how did we get there? I go back again to the aircraft carrier. These people sat down, they did tough assessments of what, how you would use this. At a time when the United States barely had any aircraft carriers, they sat down and did war games in which they said, okay, we have five aircraft carriers, the enemy has six, how does it work? What do you do? And that led to new requirements for how you, what sort of planes you would have, what sort of characteristics they had to have. They realized, oh, if you're operating in the Pacific, you need planes that can fly a long way. You need submarines to help protect your aircraft carriers. And they did a lot of thinking to redesign their force, and that led to an effective military. So the first thing you do is rather than say, who are we going to go fight, you look at what you have and say, what do we think we might want to do and how to do it? So, for example, cyber warfare. You really need to sit down and ask some basic questions about how do we want to operate computers in the world? How do we want to protect our networks? How much do we want to interfere with enemy networks? And that leads you to think, first of all, about what sort of computers you might need, but more importantly, what kind of people you might need. You might want to recruit very differently. I'm amazed that we haven't set up a good information warfare unit in Silicon Valley. And said, you know, you can come and look like a hippie. We don't care as long as you are great at cyber warfare.
I had one final question for you, and it's coming back to the political realm. There are some people who talk about the primary and caucus season and shake their heads at what is said, and then other people say, well, this is not really what's going to happen once we get down to who the nominees are and whatnot. Are you concerned at all based on what you hear from candidates on all ends of the spectrum? Are you concerned that what feels like people who are not in Washington feels like an age of hyper-partisanship? Do those sorts of elements make it harder to fight the war of the future?
You know, I'm a military reporter, not a political reporter. Mm-hmm. And any time I talk about politics, I fear that I sound as foolish as political reporters do when they talk about national security.
Okay.
That said, as a citizen, I fear for our country right now. I actually had the thought the other day that we may be drifting towards civil war in another 15 years. I actually think that part of the causes, the sort of tectonic causes of our civil war in 1861 was the shift of the Industrial Revolution and how that left the South behind. In the information age, we're leaving a big part of our country behind, and I think those are the people who are supporting people like Trump. These people suspect they are basically being screwed by the new economy that's developing, and their answer is one of anger, and they respond to candidates who are peddling anger, especially Trump, but also some other on the extreme right.
That's Thomas Ricks. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author and national security expert. He'll be speaking at ASU next Monday night at 7 p.m. as part of the Paul Schott Memorial Lecture. Tom Ricks, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll hear from Tom Holohan of the Annenberg School for Communication at USC to talk about the challenges for spokespeople when they're representing people they don't really believe in. Plus, we'll hear about the Algebra Project. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Riley Carlock and Applewhite, a business law firm helping local and national clients with corporate and securities, water and environmental, labor and employment, and other areas of the law. Details at rcalaw.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Well, should be a very pleasant day today in the valley. Sunny skies, a lot cooler than normal. The average high for today is 70 degrees, and we're looking for 56 today. Clear skies overnight with lows in the upper 30s. Sunny skies for the next couple of days. A little bit warmer, though. Highs of 64 and 68 on Friday. Well, Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. Today, President Obama visits a mosque in Baltimore. It's his first visit to a mosque in the U.S. as president. We'll also hear about how energy-producing states are coping with the drop in revenues that's come with falling oil prices. NPR's Here and Now is coming up at 12 on KJZZ. Well, every day you get in your car and listen to KJZZ during your commute, so when you buy a new car, donate your old one to KJZZ. It's a great way to contribute to the programs you love. You can rest easy. We'll take care of the details. More information is at cars.kjzz.org. It's sunny and 48 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:44.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Education is often called the equalizer in our society, the way to level the playing field for young people who are lower income or not given a direct opportunity to succeed. MacArthur Fellow and civil rights leader Bob Moses started the Algebra Project in response in 1982. He's in Arizona this week to talk about the importance of math literacy in minority and low-income communities. He's also the co-author of the book Radical Equations, Civil Rights from Mississippi to the Algebra Project. And he joins me now. Mr. Moses, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. When did you decide math literacy was going to be a vital tool for minority and low-income Americans?
Well, it was in the 1980s, and I was looking at the shift from industrial to information age technologies because the PCs started to come out in the 1980s, the little computers. You know, when I was in school in the 1950s, computers were huge machines, right?
Right.
It became clear to me that these computers were going to add a quantitative literacy to the table. In the 20th century, the previous age, the industrial technologies, it was reading and writing literacies that were needed to access the economic arrangements. Those are still needed, but there's an additional literacy, the quantitative literacy. And in our country, it's really algebra, which is the gatekeeper to those literacies.
How broadly and how big should we be thinking on this, that math literacy could help these young people get better jobs in the future, or is there something even more basic than that?
No, I think what we're looking at is the structure of our democracy. The people who were denied access to the reading and writing literacies we worked with in Mississippi, the sharecroppers, they were the serfs of the industrial economies in the 20th century. And what we're looking at now is the rise of serfdom in the 21st century. In other words, any young person leaving school with the equivalent of an eighth grade literacy standard is bound for 21st century serfdom. So we really, and the thing we have to understand is that the information age introduces a new category of work. It's called knowledge work, right?
Right.
Knowledge work now requires a command of all of those literacies, including quantitative literacy. So it's essential for democracy. The idea that has been launched by presidential candidates that we should have free college education or community college, that's fine, but that's a middle-class idea because the question is, do we have a public school education that prepares all the kids so they actually can access college, right? So until we get a public education to the standard, so all the kids, one of the big problems in the country that the country doesn't look at is that over the past 40 years, the top economic quartile of the country doubled the percent of people who got BAs from 40% to 80% from 1970 to 2010. And in that same period, the bottom economic quartile was flat. We started off at 7% getting BAs, 40 years later, just 9%. So we have gone backwards vis-a-vis the rest of the country. And we can't actually be a democracy unless we solve this problem.
Have you found that math, when you mention those numbers as far as BA goes, have you noticed that math has actually been more de-emphasized in lower-income neighborhoods, in lower-income schools, and that has created more of an inequality gap, that there's something about math in and of itself that is just, well, don't worry about math, worry about these other things? Have you found that has led to the inequality as well?
Well, what I've found is that we don't have the teachers. So yesterday we were talking to the principal of Creighton School. It's a K-8 school. He has one math teacher for 172 7th and 8th graders. He needs three more teachers, right? So we have not, as a society, agreed to provide the teaching force that's needed for this 21st century education. Neither the Republicans or the Democrats, and it's out there in terms of policy. The National Academy of Science produced a report this century, said, look, this country needs to produce 10,000 more teachers for math and science every year. Right, and it needs to pay for their production, and it needs to put money, extra money, for teachers to go into the underserved communities of the country. And both Bush and Obama just did a Hail Mary to this. Neither one of them paid any attention to it, and it's devastating.
If I may, you've had a big impact with the Algebra Project over the past few decades, and even from talking with you for a few minutes, your approach is not fire and brimstone. I mean, you're not yelling. Has that been a good approach for you? Has it become where people can, they feel like they can talk to you and understand what you're talking about?
Yes, and the thing that we now understand, and this is why we're here in Arizona, that working with Petra Falcon and Promise Arizona, because what we need is an organizing effort. Right? We need a grassroots organizing effort. We're here right now doing a workshop with some parents, getting them to understand how the language they speak, both English and Spanish, right, how that those languages, the ordinary language, right, that people speak every day as they go about shopping and doing their everyday work, that that language in and of itself is a tool to access the language of math. There are ways in which the language is... the point really is that there's no privileged linguistic access to scientific language because scientific language is based on a conceptual, regimented language that nobody speaks. And what we are showing them is how the language they speak gets regimented and then gets represented in scientific language. So this can be done. It's doable.
Okay.
Right?
Mr. Moses, MacArthur Fellow and Civil Rights Leader Bob Moses started the Algebra Project in 1982. He's also co-author of the book Radical Equations, Civil Rights from Mississippi to the Algebra Project. Great honor to talk with you, sir. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Take care.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last Wednesday on the program, I spoke with Lisa Allen, who's retiring after more than 20 years as the communications chief for Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Allen said she agreed with the sheriff most of the time, but did occasionally have to bite her tongue on certain stances he took, in particular the effort to check on President Obama's birth certificate. So what's it like to have to defend a boss's point of view when you don't agree? Tom Hollihan of the Annenberg School for Communication at USC joins me to talk about that. So, Tom, what are the challenges and how common is this?
You know, what are your responsibilities as an employee, someone who works for an individual or an organization? And what are your responsibilities to the public who would hear those messages? And what are your responsibilities to your own conscience, your own values and principles?
Indeed. And which one of those is one and which is 1A? Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, so I think it's not uncommon that people are put in situations where they're carrying out policies or giving statements that they don't personally agree with. I think that probably happens to all of us. But we also don't ever want to be in a position where we think that the words that are coming out of our mouth are going to do harm to someone or mislead someone, result in unfair, unethical treatment, or in fact might damage your own integrity and reputation.
How often do you think that is a concern for people who are employed in those situations? I guess just in a general sense, we can't make a blanket statement, but this idea that once you take a job like that, I guess you have to go in with eyes open, knowing that any elected official could run into a controversial situation.
Of course. I mean, you have to have your eyes open. For the most part, people who work for political figures, for example, have some shared political values and ideology with the person that they're working for. And the people that are making those hiring decisions want to hire people who they trust. And that trust comes from having confidence that there are some shared political values. If you find that the person you're serving is really doing something that I think you in principle oppose, then you have obligations, I think, to resign or to go public, even if it's something so serious that you say, look, I just can't support or condone this. You know, an interesting example is with the responsibilities of soldiers, for example. We expect soldiers to adhere to the orders of the commander-in-chief, but there are also very explicit principles, for example, that general officers, meaning generals and admirals, people who attain that rank, should never carry out an order if they really think it's illegal or immoral or in some ways jeopardizes what their responsibility is to the troops they lead or to the country they serve. And so those are situations in which somebody will often publicly disagree with a command and maybe take themselves out of the chain of command, resign their command. And it doesn't happen very often, but it certainly can happen, and in fact should happen. And we can think of cases where people get prosecuted for following orders that turned out to be illegal or immoral orders.
Indeed, and I guess when you're on a day-to-day basis on these things, we often don't think about the consequences. And maybe we do in a small sense, but as you said, if it turns into and blows into something larger, maybe we're not anticipating that could happen.
Right. I would say that's definitely the case. And, you know, in the case of the sheriff, he was a profoundly controversial figure. She knew he was a controversial figure. She watched the controversies that spun around him over the years develop. And in an ideal situation, your communications director isn't just your mouthpiece. It's someone who's offering advice and counsel about the strategies that you should be following. And we teach it at USC workshops and in our courses, this notion that you should put communication at the center of everything that you do. So rather than make a judgment or make a decision and then say, how can I sell this or how can I convince somebody to adhere to it, you should instead have your communication people in the decision-making process talking to you about how this is going to impact the different stakeholders that are going to be impacted by your decision. And, you know, in the case of the sheriff, your stakeholders are the citizens, the legislators, those who have a responsibility to cover the costs if you make a mistake and screw up because you know it's going to result in sometimes costly litigation, and even those who the sheriff's office arrests or detains or keeps in their jails are stakeholders in the kinds of decisions that are being made and into what's being communicated. So you want somebody who understands the complexity of all of these issues as they unfold.
If an elected official, for example, is going through really good times, they're probably less likely to consult with the communications experts. And the communications experts are often brought in more when there's crisis to be dealt with. And then that puts that person on the spot as well.
Well, it depends. I mean, I don't think that's true in politics anymore. I think that may be true in a lot of corporate settings.
Okay.
But I think in politics nowadays, almost everything involves your communication people, particularly as, you know, you move up in the ranks of elected officials. They're always taking the public's temperature with regard to attitudes about things, and they're always considering how issues are going to likely play out in the next campaign. And indeed, governing nowadays is very much, you know, governing is conducted much like a campaign.
There's the phrase drinking the Kool-Aid, and it seems that there are a lot of people, anyone who works for a high-profile figure, but also communications figures as well, who end up going in thinking, okay, maybe I agree with some of what this person does, but not all of it. How much of a danger can that be for a communications professional to end up sort of drinking the Kool-Aid of the person they're working for?
Well, I think it's a risk that happens not just to communication people, but to anybody who is carrying out the policies of someone who they generally agree with and respect. And of course, your interests and their interests come to be aligned if you're depending upon someone for your paycheck, and if your career trajectory is you're trying to serve your career interest by having this person, you know, say kind words about you and recommend you for the next position you're going to take following your assignment. So I think that's always, you know, sort of a challenge that people face. And if you're around too much on the inside of things, you tend to have an inside perspective, and you tend sometimes not to be sensitive to outside or external views. So one of the things we always emphasize when we talk about putting communication at the center is developing a listening plan so that you're not presuming what your stakeholders want or what your stakeholders understand or believe, but you're actively surveying them. You're monitoring their feedback. You're assessing what's appearing in social media, for instance, which is a place for the production as well as consumption of content, to discern as much as you can about your stakeholders' understandings and their interests and their passions and commitments and their anxieties before you act.
That's Tom Holohan, professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on the program. And thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear my conversations with Michael Crow, Tom Ricks, or Bob Moses, or one of our previous programs, please go online to KJZZ.org later this afternoon. This is KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, exploring African-American identity and history. Artist Betty Saar turns everyday objects into works of art. Betty Saar's Still Ticking, now on view. More at smoka.org.